Today's program has been brought to you by Roberta's Pizza, robertaspizza.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Fancy girls in their fancy dresses and their lipstick, laughing and dancing. But you stop them, don't you? I can't stop them. But you do, don't you?
Oh yes, the very creepy voice of actor Joe Spinelli welcoming us to Eating Disorder on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Crazy Legs Conti, along with...
I'm here, it's the Reverend Spiro. And what do we do at Christmas? We talk about gore movies.
We do, and it's odd, though, that line from Joe Spinelli, from the great movie Maniac, is actually apropos to what the Rev and I are seeing in front of us.
Oh, it's ridiculous. We usually see the first date table.
That's true, at Roberta's in the
back.
But
today at Roberta's, honestly, what's going on? It is an orgy of gift-giving amongst what looks like, I'm going to say this is a bachelorette.
It seems a bachelorette, but each, they're doing sort of a Santa swap, each girl, and there's about 40 girls. They've taken over the back room. I saw a few of them tittering about me when I was walking by, so I had my hopes up, but this is really too many well-gussied up women to handle at once. So I have a feeling, even though I'd like to put my phone number in one of the bags, that we're probably going to have to hold off. The Reverend is closest to one woman.
At the same time. There's been four Nutella gifts.
Yes, a lot of Nutella gifts. At the moment, there is a statuesque blonde in a leather wraparound skirt.
It would be like, you know, like glasses with penises on them.
This is a classy crowd. She's got a lot of rings. Yeah. A lot of jewelry, and she's pointing to a bag. The matronly woman is waving her off the polka dot bag. We're going to introduce our guest in a moment, but she went for a red spangly bag and a bottle of Sky Vodka.
Yeah!
And she is showing off her perfectly pearly whites. We like the Sky Vodka.
Yes.
Anyway,
yes.
You heard a clip from one of the most seminal horror films that has since been remade. We chose to go with Joe Spinelli's voice as opposed to Elijah Wood's, but we like both them and their performances in the respective Maniacs. And the list of the films that this next gentleman who's going to join us via phone from the left coast is impressive, not only in its depth and breadth, but in its subject matter, which normally someone gets pigeonholed as a horror film director, and many of their films are the same. There's suspenseful directors, twist directors, gore directors.
It's Grindhouse.
Yes.
William
Bill Lustig, Bill as I know him, has covered genres that are almost untapped in the horror film and cinematic world of politics and history and sci-fi and fantasy and just good old-fashioned drama. Vigilante justice and whatnot. So we welcome to Eating Disorder my good friend Bill Lustig. Bill, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing? What's the weather like back in New York? Is it?
It's okay.
Today,
it's not bad. It's you know what? There was a great scene in The Wire where one of the thug lords talks about a 40-degree day, and you can't complain about a 40-degree day, but you can also not, you know, celebrate a 40-degree day.
Well, we've had a lot of 40-degree days. The weather out here is, it was like in the 60s today, and I've become such a wimp that I actually had to call the maintenance people to fix the heating
in my
apartment because I was really chilly.
Yes. In New York, and Bill is a New Yorker through and through.
Right? I've become thin-skinned.
Well, this would be a day you would have your slice of Pizza Joe's at the outside table versus the indoor table.
Yeah. So, gotcha.
Now, you grew up in New York.
Yes, well, I grew up, actually, I was born in the Bronx, but when I was 7 years old, my family, as well as all the other relatives, split to varying suburbs. We went to Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. Other family members went to Long Island, upstate New York. But, you know, it was funny because in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, I was closer to Manhattan than I was in the Bronx.
Right.
Now I hear you. I'm in Queens, and you were probably closer than I am to Manhattan.
Yeah, I mean, I really, to me, my whole world always gravitated to the city, not to lower New Jersey. I can't relate to, like, Jersey Shore or anything.
Yes. Now, one of those relatives is the boxer Jake LaMotta. He's your
uncle.
He was
the last to move out of Manhattan.
Okay, so he hung in there. So did you feel like you had a tough uncle overlooking you? Like, did you grow up in a rough-and-tumble environment?
I wouldn't say it was necessarily more rough-and-tumble than anybody else growing up in working class New York, but it was interesting because my uncle was the only family member who encouraged my dreams, because I wanted to make movies when I was in my teens.
Your education was in the movie theaters of Times Square and whatnot.
Exactly. But my uncle used to always say, you know, if you can conceive it, you can achieve it. You know, that was his thing. You know, he would point to his hands and say, these are not the hands of a middleweight champion. Because he did. He had very delicate hands. It almost looked like a pianist hands, not a boxer hands. There was nothing rough and tumble about him.
Well, you brought up Times Square. I mean, you know, a few of your movies have been looked at as some of the last grindhouse classics. You know,
yeah, well, I mean, I definitely made an imprint on Times Square, that's for sure.
No, but were you, you know, kind of influenced by what came before you in Times Square?
I'm influenced to this day by my going to Times Square when I was a kid.
One of the things Bill often does when he commutes back to New York is he'll have screenings of really what I would consider undiscovered gems, a lot from the 70s, but even from before or after, that are films that a lot of people don't know about. I think recently you did
Shockwaves,
and previously you were so successful at showing these movies that, like, the Film Anthology Archives and different cinemas, they asked you to curate series where you would show three or four of sort of the films that you grew up on that influenced you, but were not the ones that are the best known by the going public today.
Well, for 4 years, I curated a series. Actually, it was more than four films. I used to have to come up with anywhere from 12 to 14 films for each of the series. It was at the archives, the Anthology Film Archive, mm-hmm. where it was called William Lustig Presents, and I was showing films that up till that time had not been available on DVD.
Oh, that's true.
And then what sort of phased the series out is the same studios that I was cultivating these films from. They started to start their own burn on DVD, you know, burn on demand DVD labels. So now all these films, most of them are available now on DVD. Okay. But I'd like to think I played a role in getting the studios off their butts and putting them out.
Can you give us a little?
Yeah, I remember going to see with you Freebie and the Bean,
right?
With Alan Arkin, yeah. And you said, "Listen, there's going to be this car scene that you're going to want to pay attention to, because in the movie they drive a car into the third story apartment building, and sure enough, what they did was actually drive a car into the third
story. These were pre CGI.
Yeah.
And you've always been a big proponent of actual stunts and actual kind of incredible visual scenarios.
Well, I was a proponent only because I didn't have access to CGI when I made my films.
Right.
The Maniac Cop films preceded any CGI.
And you still, I think it's, I'm trying to remember which one. There's a jump, or really a push off a building, or there's a stuntman falling in one of them that it seems impossible. You know, Tom Cruise couldn't have done it any better with a $100 million budget. So.
Well, I was blessed. I had a stunt coordinator on the Maniac Cop films, as well as Relentless and Uncle Sam. His name is Spiro Rosados, and now he's the number one stunt coordinator in the world. Really, wow. He does all those Fast and Furious films, and
really?
Yeah, he started on them. In fact, we were talking. Oh God, it was in the summer, and we were talking about, you know, that he said, Bill, I do it on the Fast and Furious films exactly what we did on Maniac Cop, only I have access to more money.
Right. Yes. Probably nicer cars.
And insurance.
Yeah. And then, Bill, one of the movies you mentioned, which is a favorite of mine by yours, is Uncle Sam, which I believe is from 96, about a war veteran from modern day war.
Right.
Who comes back from the dead to exact his revenge on the unpatriotic citizens of his hometown.
Right. And it's, right. Yeah, that film is one of those that has a kind of a cult following. It's interesting because that film comes up periodically. It was funny. It was very successful when it came out on VHS back then, mm-hmm. but then it hasn't really, as far as commercially, hasn't really stood the test of time as the Maniac Cop films have. But still, it has its cult following, and I do get asked to screen the film quite often.
The Maniac Cop film's got a cult following that none of your other movies did. I mean, Maniac Cop as well. I mean, there are movie geeks out there who love. There are movie geeks out there who hate this movie, but there are movie geeks out there who love this movie and its sequel. From the standpoint of the same genre as the Jason films and the Freddy Krueger films, and as the killer with, you know, a face kind of thing,
yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. Being that he was a scarred up individual, etc.
Well, I think that the difference. I think Maniac Cop had a distinction in those films that you mentioned, in that it was kind of a hybrid movie. Mm-hmm. We made it as the first one, the first Maniac Cop. I really thought of it as an RKO film noir. Mm-hmm. That's how I approached
that.
It.
I like that.
And then when I did the second film, I still kept the RKO film noir. In fact, when I told Robert Davi, the only direction I really gave Robert Davi is I said, you're Robert Ryan in an RKO film
okay,
noir.
Nice.
And that's what I told him, and he said, oh, I got it.
Yeah.
You know? But you know, I kind of thought of the second one as a kind of a Frankenstein meets the French Connection. And
I thought of the
monster with the guy who was the serial killer. I had this. I gave the actor who played the serial killer. I said, "You're Bela Lugosi in Son of Frankenstein."
Oh, but he was like Popeye Doolin.
The Hungarian accent. He did the white trash accent.
Excellent.
Awesome. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's how we approached it, and so it made it fun for me because I was able to kind of pull my favorite things from those movies. You know, the lair that the serial killer lives in and brings the maniac cop home kind of looks like one of those Universal monster movie sets.
Yeah, and I was a big fan of those, like, you know, Hammer films and whatnot. I do have a question though. I mean, do you think you'd be able to make that movie today? And honestly, I am a bleeding heart liberal. I'd love you to make Maniac Cops the true story.
Let me tell you. I never thought of Maniac Cop. Maniac Cop is in a much broader sense. It's more of a societal thing mm-hmm. than a cop actually beating up anybody. You
right.
know, it's
okay.
it's about a. It was about really a cop who did his job, vigorously, mm-hmm. and was and started to infringe on the politicians and their no goodness. You know, the things they were up to no good with.
Right, right.
So they framed him and threw him into prison. And so he becomes this kind of restless spirit. In the first film, I always thought of him as being kind of a ghost rather than a zombie.
Right,
even
right.
in the second one, I always I teetered between thinking of him as a zombie and thinking of him as a ghost. I never really made up my mind. I kind of made up my mind whatever would work for the scenes. But the thing was, it was never about a guy who was... Like, choking and shooting, you know, criminals, you know?
Right.
I mean, that to me is the thing he would be against.
Yes, so many of your films are touch on the subject of, you know, vigilantism, but it's responsible vigilantism. It's
like the film vigilante.
Like, yes, but it seems to be you take great pains to show that the people who are dying are the bad guys of today's society in different genres and things.
Well, I mean, in the case of vigilante, I really thought about it as a spaghetti western. Mm-hmm. And so I treated, for instance, the people who were the working class stiffs living in Queens who were trying to, you know, live a life, and you had these criminals that were preying upon them.
Mm-hmm.
So it became, in my mind, no different than, say, a John Wayne Western or a spaghetti Western, where these guys have to strap on the guns and protect themselves and their neighborhood.
I
even shot it and stylized it like a spaghetti western.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna run through a break, but before that, I want to have one last conversation with you. Bruce Campbell was in Maniac Cop,
the greatest.
And, we love Bruce Campbell, but let's talk about it. Like, what was it like working with him? What was, you know, his shtick wasn't there yet. I mean, I loved him in the movie, but it wasn't you know.
Well, he wasn't doing shtick. He had done Evil Dead 2 before he did Maniac Cop.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Evil Dead 2 had been released around the time that I hired him for Maniac Cop.
Okay.
Bruce was a friend of mine. So was Sam Raimi and Rob Tabbert, that whole Evil Dead group. I knew them from the first Evil Dead film. And I always got a kick out of Bruce Campbell, and I thought that Bruce had this real interesting leading man, almost in a sense that he had a leading man from a different period.
Right.
You know, he has that look about him, that handsome, square chin look.
I believe his autobiography is called "If This Chin Could Talk."
Yeah, exactly. You know, he had that look. You know, he had this look of a real old fashioned leading man. And so I kind of dug him because I kind of wanted it. As I told you, my thought of Maniac Cop 1 was that it was an old film noir. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if Bruce Campbell was the ultimate film noir victim?
Yes.
And that's what I thought would be fun. You know, here he is. He's been, you know, he was, yes, he was committing adultery, but his adultery led to the death of his wife, who he is suspected of killing, but he knows he hasn't killed her, so he has to find the person who did kill her in order to vindicate himself.
Yes.
So that was always what was interesting. I thought Bruce would be that perfect victim, you know?
Yep, and it's true. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to stay on the line, Bill. We're going to take a short station identification break. When we come back, let's keep talking about some of your luminaries and certainly the remakes and what's on the way. We're on with Bill Lustig, and we'll be back in 2 minutes and 33 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are Very delicious. It must be Heritage Radio.
I think we're back. Andrew W.K. welcoming us back in his usual very excited, abrupt fashion. This is Eating Disorder on the HeritageRadio.org network. And we're on with Bill Lustig, a phenomenal film director. And we've been talking about some of his horror films from the 80s and into the 90s. And now that it is into the 2000s, there's been a real resurgence. I know originally, Bill, a bunch of directors, people like Quentin Tarantino and others, Robert Rodriguez, would contact you for maybe, let's call it, polite usage or an homage to either a movie poster of yours or a scene from a movie you had shot to sort of give you the heads up that they wanted to co-opt that image or scene.
Well, actually, the two people that did incorporate clips from my movies into their films was Maciej Katsiewicz, French director, and Nicholas Winding Refn, who I became very good friends with.
He had his first film, Valhalla, sort of an amazing Norseman tale, and then he's gone on to do things like Driven and Drive, thank you, and the recent sort of Jordowski-esque Ryan Gosling, Only God Forgives, which I thought was phenomenal. So those directors obviously had looked to you for influence, and then it seemed some of your films had come up in the cycle of Hollywood to say, hey, these are great movies that we'd like to, you know, bring up to the modern era. In the case of Maniac, it means taking Joe Spinelli, who is a pudgy sort of, you look at him and you think the performance is so creepy and suggestive, to today's actor, who is a wide-eyed Elijah Wood. How much were you involved in that remake? And then you have some other films that are being remade as well.
Yeah, well, there's a remake, or I should say really a reboot or a reimagination of Maniac Cop that I'm working on with Nick Winding Refn. And in the case of the Maniac one with Elijah Wood, I really had minimal involvement with the creative end of the movie. And it wasn't Hollywood that came calling, interesting enough. It was a French production company.
Okay.
So, and the same company is doing the Maniac Cop one.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
But I mean, my gripe with remakes and what's going on with just Hollywood in general, it's just the fact that the whole grindhouse thing, the idea of exploitation movies, the idea of, you know, we're creating horror movies that have a theme that are like, okay, you couldn't have made a movie called Terrorist after 9/11, and making a movie called Maniac Cop after Ferguson could be iffy, you know. And what I'm saying is, from the entertainment standpoint, from the horror standpoint specifically, and you can use the exploitation standpoint if you want, we've just become giant pussies. We really have. It's like when it comes down to what kind of movies we want to see and what we're doing, it's just always about like, oh, well, who are we going to offend? Meanwhile, we're making these torture porn movies, you know, like The Audition, which I love, which is a great movie. Right, but yet it's Asian, so we don't have to worry about it because it's not our culture, right? And then it's horribly, horribly disturbing. But oh, well, we don't want to talk about anything happening now. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you kind of went all over the place. I couldn't really follow exactly what your train of thought was. That it was,
don't worry, nobody else can.
I don't really.
Well, how do you feel about some of your films coming into today's world and society? Have the themes changed, or do you feel that they're strong enough to maintain?
Certainly, things are going to change slightly, but you know, when I look at a film like Maniac, the Maniac Cop films, honestly, they don't become real dated.
Mm-hmm.
Because cops and criminals have existed from time infinitum. You know, it's the way it is. I mean, you know, it's society. I mean, maybe the technology might change, But as far as conceptually, you know, it's no different. It really is.
Yeah, but the way cops are perceived, like in the 70s, cops were perceived to some level from the exploitation side as villains. And then, you know, coming to the 80s, you had Dirty Harry. You had, you know, where the cop turns into the vigilante.
Well, actually, you have to go back. Dirty Harry was the early 70s.
70s, okay. Yeah. So it changed a little bit to the standpoint where the cop is now the hero.
Well, it's really an anti-hero. It's like French Connection. You know, Gene Hackman is an anti-hero. I mean, none of the cops you mentioned, like Dirty Harry, is a hero in the old fashioned John Wayne sense. You know, these are people that are definitely anti-heroes.
Yeah, but in today's news, there's not a lot of
cheer them on.
But we don't
look at them. We cheer them on, warts and all. But we realize that they are not, you know, the heroes that are red, white, and blue, you know.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
You know, pure in a pure sense.
Yeah. And one of the things you've also been able to do, not only with your own films, but other films, is for a long time you've run Blue Underground, which is a distribution business, puts out titles a lot of times that have not been seen in the U.S. And the one thing that I and so many people who go to Blue Underground for their films love is that you are fully committed to packing a disc with extras, as many extras as you can get, not only audio commentaries, but things from the shoot, documentaries about the shoot, and then new interviews and updated footage. And where does that commitment come from?
Well, the commitment came from being a proactive collector. When I was in the back in the 90s, there was a format called Laserdisc,
right,
that some of us film buffs were really clinging to as the format of the day.
For those who don't know, it looked like bigger than a record, and you had to flip it to get to the.
It was like an LP size disc, in today's world, it looks very crude, but back then it was state of the art.
Right.
And my frustration was that in the States, the films that I really wanted to own on Laserdisc weren't available.
Right.
And that I had to go to places like Japan and pay at the time an extraordinary amount of money. I paid like $450 for a Laserdisc of City of the Living Dead from Japan.
Yes.
I mean, I would just tell you how nuts it was. Serendipity rules. I happened to be visiting a friend in England who was doing some business with the owners of Hammer, and from that, I made a relationship with Hammer that resulted in my licensing 20-some-odd movies from them.
Wow.
And then I began licensing more movies from other companies until one day I got to the point where I went to Rome, where a lot of the films that I wanted to see were the owners were there.
Can you talk
sat
about,
in a hotel
about which...
room literally with a checkbook and contracts and was buying up movies like Suspiria Deep Red anything that was available at the time, I was just buying up.
And these were Dario Argento, these were great suspense masters, these were zombie films, these were
classic monster movies.
I own Zombie, the movie Zombie, I own that in perpetuity. I mean, I just was a proactive collector. And then once I had done that, I now was tasked with having to, you know, do all the extras that I could do and everything else and put them out. And it was, it was quite a job. And, you know, but these films have longevity. You know, they're not perishable films.
Yeah, and there you can check them out at Blue Underground. And with full disclosure, the way I know Bill is that a mutual friend knew I would enjoy his company, and we would go see movies, and we both enjoy food. And at the time, a documentary about my competitive eating career had no distribution. And Bill, through his company, had maybe a poor experience with a previous documentary. I think it was one on Al Goldstein.
As much as I didn't want to be compared to Al Goldstein,
I wanted Bill to distribute the doc. And at some point, he said, you know, you like movies. I like movies, that you like food. I like, why don't we distribute this and see if it goes anywhere? And one thing you said was do as many extras as you want. And the thing that exists today with Netflix and people ask, oh, where can I see that doc? I say, well, just buy it from Blue Underground and take some time with it because you're going to want to work through all these extras. Right. So, and now, you know, you're still putting out films, you're still supporting films. And in the little bit of time we have left, you have some luminaries in the business that, you know, are your coworkers essentially, but you support each other. And I know last week you went to a very sort of private function for Bob Downey Sr. that I think
Bob is an old deal friend.
And it was he was interviewed by his son, Robert Downey Jr., also known as Iron Man. And how is that event? Is that something that you do frequently, seeing a lot of the filmmakers?
Oh, I do, yeah. Whenever I can. I mean, Bob is such a... I really love Bob. His movie Putney Swope was definitely a film that pushed me into making movies. Hmm. I absolutely love that movie. And so it was great. I loved Bob Downey Jr. is really a great kid. I mean, I call him a kid, but you know, the last time I had been in Bob Downey Jr.'s company was when his father was babysitting him over a New Year's Eve thing. You know, he was it was at Greenblatt's Deli in Los Angeles, and his father had been with his son all night, you know, making sure that he didn't get into, you know, any kind of trouble.
Okay.
And this was about 15 years ago. And seeing his son and, you know, hanging out with him and his father and everything again, I mean, you know, it's just such a, it was so nice. You know, it was really, really nice. And he stood up in front of the audience. This is, you know, he was so, it's so disarming. He stood up in front of the audience and said, you know, I've had a couple of good years and a few hundred million dollars, so I decided to go back and restore my dad's movies.
Very nice.
And I thought that was such a wonderful opening, you know?
Yeah.
He said, you know, I kind of made it to the top of the superhero food chain.
Yeah. And I read an interview, so that was the son sort of thanking the father, but I believe I read an interview where they asked the father, like, what was your proudest moment in film? And he said, seeing my son as a father and clean and sober and just living life to the fullest. So I think that's certainly inspiring.
That's really what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, the father and son love each other so much, and it's that kind of closeness you don't often see.
Yes. And I guess let's bring it back to your family. I know, was it a year ago that Jake LaMotta was trying to get Raging Bull 2 made?
Well, it actually got made.
Okay.
It did.
It's actually made. I saw it a year ago. And the film is unreleasable. but I did see it. And it was a big production.
Uh-huh.
They spent north of $6-7 million on the movie. For an independent film, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you know, I had a lot of names, but you know, it's one of those things it's so obvious that
they can't fix it in the edit. I mean,
no, it's just the director is god awful, the writing is god awful. I mean, just on the most fundamental levels. Mm. I mean, you know, for somebody to decide they're going to make a Raging Bull 2, that whole thought is so misguided that it really tells you what you're up against as far as the talent, you know, making the project.
That's
for them to even consider doing it is so ludicrous.
But
I got one last question, though. I want to know from the grindhouse, from the old exploitation film level. Do you feel that that's like a lost art form? Do you think that that could still happen today the way it happened in the 70s and whatnot?
No, it's different. And the difference is that we don't live... The entertainment business is no longer a democracy.
Oh.
It's a business where the theaters are monopolized by the major studios and the major independents. And in order to play in that game, you have to make a film on a certain level. You can't be just Now, will there always be that cheap movie that's going to break through and make $100 million like a Blair Witch or a Paranormal Activity? Of course, that is that kind of anomaly is going to happen. But that's not a business.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's not something anybody would say, gee, I'm going to go out and do those kind of movies and plan to make money. It's just waiting for lightning to strike.
Mm-hmm. Ah, gotcha.
Very good. Well, we have just thoroughly enjoyed this time with you. Bill Lustig, famed director of many genres, and check out Blue Underground. Is there anything else you wanted to highlight or mention, Bill, before we let you go?
Or shill. Be a shameless shill. Do it.
No, I mean, that's it. Thank you for calling me up. I'm sorry I'm not eating pizza with you guys. Like, are you doing this from that pizza
party? We are. The pizza we're eating, which unfortunately you're going to miss out on, it's not a traditional New York pizza. This one has, is that gorgonzola and honey?
Gorgonzola on honey.
Yeah, we do fancy pizzas in Bushwick. But we know you're an old-school New York
Jesus.
Guy.
I'm a John's guy or a Joe. My pizza is all on Bleecker Street.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is called a Jesus H. Christ.
Yes. But it's been great. So, Bill Lustig, we're going to say goodbye to you. We look forward to...
All right, fellas. Thank you very much.
Have wonderful holidays.
And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Happy Hanukkah.
Yes.
Stay well, okay?
Thank you, Bill. All right. And for this edition of Eating Disorder, I am Crazy Legs Conti, my co-host...
The Rev Spiro.
We're looking forward to next week. Julie Alice Muirs is here. It will be our non-office party at the Hipster Strip Club. Pumps. So get there after the show. But tune into heritageradio.org. Buy some fancy turkeys. Eat some pizza at Roberta's. And I'm going to wade out into the bachelorette party and see if I can get into some trouble. Happy holidays.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.